Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Natural History Museum of Utah. I'm Sarah George, the Executive Director, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to the Rio Tinto Center this evening as we continue our 2018 lecture series, The Genius of Nature, Bio-Inspired Design. As many of you are probably aware, this spring our special exhibition, Nature's Ultimate Machines, explores the biomechanics of animals and plants, including how they inspire human engineering innovation. The lecture series planning committee thought this would be a great direction to go in thinking about this year's series, and with that, they set off to look for nature-inspired designers to bring to Salt Lake. The exciting designers you'll be hearing from over the next few weeks work in fields ranging from architecture to media arts as they explore the growing imperative for coexistence between people and planet. I want to thank our fabulous sponsors and partners who make it possible for the museum to host this series each year. We're particularly grateful to our founding underwriter, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, and our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund, for their tremendous ongoing support of the series. We'd like to thank Rio Tinto Kennecott, our gold sponsor, silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DiFiore Family Foundation, the M. Lazy M. Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. Our media partner is KCPW 88.3 FM, and our community partners are the City Library in downtown Salt Lake, Kingsbury Hall, Liberty Heights Fresh, and the County Library at the Viridian Event Center in West Jordan. So. And finally, many, many thanks to the voters of Salt Lake County. Your strong approval of the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund provides invaluable support for this museum and for many, many other cultural organizations throughout the county. So thank you to these wonderful partners and supporters. And now let me introduce tonight's speaker, Senior Hardware Engineer at Google, James McClurkin. Dr. McClurkin is interested in distributed algorithms for multi-agent systems. What the heck does that mean? Okay, that is, he writes software that produces complex group behaviors from the interactions of many simple individuals. So think about murmuration of starlings, schooling of fish, or swarming of insects. Animals have exhibited this type of behavior for 120 million years, and we can learn a lot from them to develop multi-robot systems. So tonight, Dr. McClurkin will illustrate the case for large populations of robots with a 12-robot team of his own. Please join me in welcoming James McClurkin.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I had the joy of walking around the dinosaur exhibit to see this wonderful museum, the architecture, the design. It's a special place, and you guys are all lucky to be here with it. But that's enough. You didn't hear me here to gush about your museum. You already know it's wonderful. You wanted me here to gush about robots. So let's get going. Okay. So in the future, robots are swarms. Why 1,000 robots are better than one. And this work that you're seeing is mostly based on my academic work while I was at Rice University. And in the Q&A session, I'll talk a little bit about the things I'm doing now that I'm at Google. So the first step is to realize that the robot revolution has already begun, and it is being televised. Here's a robot. They've sold, last time I checked, about 3 million of these guys. And it's a useful robot, in spite of the fact that it's really not very smart at all. Does anybody have one? Has anyone used one of these? And the hands that are up, they can attest that it bounces around if they have one of the lower ones. There exist fancy ones now. But the less fancy ones bounce around somewhat randomly, and they clean your floor. And the big breakthrough was realizing that most people don't care if the robot vacuums their floor exactly once. They care if the robot vacuums the floor at least once. So if it goes over some areas 4 or 5 times, 20 times, you're not there hopefully to watch it act kind of silly. That's just fine. You come home to a clean floor. Here's another robot. This is Honda's Asimo. And Asimo's job is to help people. We spent the last maybe 10,000 years building human-sized and human-shaped architecture. So if a robot's going to be useful to somebody in their house, the robot's going to need to be about 4 feet tall, be able to climb stairs, and then reach into your cabinet and get a cup out of the main cupboard. That's the robot, by the way, in the middle right there, in case you're wondering. So human-sized, human-shaped to work in human-built environments. Here's another robot up there in the upper left. That's iRobot's PackBot. And iRobot sends them out looking like that. Sometimes they come back looking like that. If you visit iRobot, the last time I was there, they still had it on the wall. That's robot number 65. It was aggressively disassembled. And the postcard says, iRobot, thank you for all your support. You have saved lives today. So regardless of your views on our foreign policy, what we're doing overseas, that's far better than the alternative. So here's our famous three Ds of robotics, tasks that are dangerous, dirty, and dull. These are things that humans either really don't want to be doing or are ill-suited to do, send in the robots. The D that I work on is the fourth D, the little-known fourth D of robotics, distributed. So if you've got a warehouse filled of fun things from Amazon, for example, so this is a picture of Kiva Systems before they were bought by Amazon. And let's say you buy, that book right there on that shelf. The robot takes the shelf with your book on it, picks it up, and wheels it over to that person over there in the red shirt, and she takes your book off the shelf and puts it in the box and mails it to you. So you've inverted the warehouse distribution selection problem, picking problem, from one of people running around the warehouse looking for items to one of robots bringing shelves to people. And that kind of inversion of the problem only works with large number of robots. In this picture, I think in this warehouse they had 980, but that was probably, oh my goodness. We're going back probably 6 years for this photo. So certainly since Amazon bought them, they've expanded greatly since then. But this is a great example of how with enough population of robots, you can totally reimagine your problem. So here's a problem, right? We have forest fires. What if we had enough robots who could look for hotspots in forest fires, keep firefighters safe? Earthquakes. Here's a task that we are uniquely ill-suited to perform. We're either too big to get inside the rubble or we're too weak to lift the rubble off should we find a survivor. So for this problem, I imagine a whole ecosystem of robots, a bunch of cockroach-sized robots. After 6 years in Houston, my notion of how big a cockroach is somewhat exaggerated, but I imagine a bunch of cockroach-sized robots that would scurry around looking for signs of life. They would then relay their findings to a bunch of rat-sized, I grew up in New York, so my notion of rats is influenced, but a bunch of rat-sized structural engineer robots who would then compute the structural dynamics, where the earthquake was, how the building collapsed, and then solve the reverse Jenga problem of getting the person out safely. They would then relay the instructions to a bunch of usually I say brontosaurus size, but I know they're no more brontosaurus. Apatosaurus, that's a good sign? Okay, so they relay their instructions to a bunch of apatosaurus-sized robots who would then reach down and do the very careful, dexterous manipulation of the rubble to get the person out. So this is a task that humans just can't do at all. And now with robots, we can potentially solve this problem. But my favorite task is sending robots to Mars. Are the most number of robots we've ever had on Mars before is two. That seems like not enough to explore a whole planet. What if we had 2,000 instead? And that brings us to our demo. Let me get a second. These little people over here were taking a little nap. The reason I don't have them on when I start talking is I've learned the hard way that if the robots are on stage, and they're on, nobody listens to a word I'm saying. Thank you. Okay, so for this demo, I'm gonna be driving that robot right there with the flashing blue light. This one over here, this is just my host to the swarm. So it hears my remote control and relays it to all the robots so they all hear voices in their heads. So off we go. So let's say we land on Mars. Splat. First thing we want to do is get the robots to form up and go off to work. Oh, the people who are in the cheap seats in the back, The robots are only 5 inches tall. I'll ask that maybe the younger set of people can come on up to the front so they can get a good close look. It's also on the screen, as you can see, but it's always good seeing these things in person. So people who are, you know, under the age of like 20, you know, coming up, and people who are, you know, technically insatiably curious, why don't you come on up too? Maybe without the age limit. Okay, splat, you land on Mars. Now we want to go off and look for fossils on Mars. So let's send the robots off to work. I'm going to ask for 7 robots to form a line to go off to work. So I've asked for 7 robots to form a line. I don't care what 7 I get, as long as I get 7. And they are picking amongst themselves who's going to be in my team and who's not. So we have the one that I'm driving, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Look at that, they can count. And the way this algorithm works is that the one that I'm driving is special because it hears the voice in its head. And that one says, you're 2 of 7. That one turns around and says, you're 3 of 7 and 4 of 7 and so forth and so on until we end up with 7 robots to go off and go off to some site. Now, maybe this first robot is being directed by an engineer at NASA, a scientist at NASA, but somehow they can all now follow each other to the site. Okay, now that we're all here, let's get them to all gather in one location. So they're all now clustering onto one spot. The way they're moving is that each robot has a set of infrared transmitters and receivers around the perimeter of the robot. So each robot can talk to its neighbors within about a meter, and then they can also know where their neighbors are. So they get not just communication, but they also get geometry, they get localization. Having all of your robots in one spot on Mars is pretty useless, so let's get them to spread out. Okay, so no, these robots do not have cliff detectors. They will happily drive off the stage. Now that we've spread out, if we're done exploring this area, we can make a flocking algorithm and have them all move off. Notice how they're not quite flocking perfectly. As a grad student, I thought, this is easy. Well, I'll fix this real quick. But then when I was a professor, I had one of my grad students work on this for a little while. 2 years, 3 papers later, we finally came up with a good algorithm to get them to do what's called coherent configuration control. Basically, to flock and not fall off the stage while they do it. So I'm going to help 19 a little bit because having robots crash into the ground is really not the way to start your lecture. Okay, so we've flocked, we've explored. Let's say we find something interesting on Mars. One of the joys of being the project leader is I get to pick all the music. Okay, so let's say we find a nice shiny black shoe on Mars. That would be an epic find. If we found that fossil, we would then want to study that. Maybe this robot over here has an alpha mass spectrometer and wants to study that fossil. So I've already told you that they use infrared light to communicate. I've told you the range is about 1 meter. So that means that this robot can't talk to that robot. So let me ask the gallery here in the front, how can this robot know how to get to that one over there?
They send the message from one robot to another, and another, until it
finally gets back. So what she said was they build a distributed ad hoc communication network, and then they make a breath-first tree. But no, you got it completely right. And if you watch, do you play a musical instrument? So if you watch carefully, every 5 seconds, this robot plays a middle C. And then you can watch as that sound goes down the chain of robots, and it goes by one whole step each time it bounces from robot to robot to robot. So that's their actual communication network. You can see the speeds of the message. That's the actual speed of the data as it's moving through the network. It's not particularly fast, turns out, and that was the theme of my PhD thesis, to try to understand the speed of communication and how that affects their algorithms. So this one is now navigating through the network, trying to get to the source of the signal. So it's routing itself the same way email would route in the internet. And then a mean engineer moves the cheese. That's okay, though. This network is designed to be distributed. It's designed to be on robots, so it's dynamic. It has to be able to update and reevaluate. See, I love it when this happens. So I've got math I've got proof to say they cannot do that. There you go. So as an aside, that's why I always work with real hardware, because you get things, they break, right? You want to have these things fail to understand the errors. If you do it in simulation, as my undergraduate would say, all doomed to succeed, which is very bad. Okay, so we've got our fossil. What's next? Oh, let's do some work. So we're going to break up into three groups. And let's see, I've got greens over here, blues over here. So the robots pick their group randomly, and they pick a leader in each group. I've not explained that. I'll explain that in a second. And then they have to cluster to their groups. And you see they got some kind of situation. Okay, they've got to sort it out. But again, those kinds of errors are okay. We have three separate groups. Lovely, lovely. So now we've done our work in three groups. Let us now keep our fossil safe. Let's move you to the center. So I've asked for the even-numbered robots to flash their red lights, and they're going to cluster around the fossil. And the odd-numbered robots are going to flash their blue lights, and they're going to patrol the perimeter of our find. So now the fossil is safe as long as whatever is on Mars is scared of a 5-inch-tall robot. Okay, we've done our clustering, we've done our fossiling. Now it's time for us to leave Mars, and we want to do so in an orderly fashion. So let me explain, let me go back a little bit and explain about leader selection. This robot here, I've said, is the leader. That's the one I'm driving with the control. And you can tell it's the leader because it's flashing its blue light. The robots actually can't see each other, so the only way they know it's the leader is through its messages. So when I pull this one out, you'll notice they'll miss it eventually, but they're not terribly sentimental. So they quickly elect another robot to be leader. The one that's now the leader, and they'll all pay attention to this one. If I put this one back, this one says, bummer, I'm not the leader anymore, and they go right back. So it's called self-stabilization, where I always only want one leader. I don't care who it is, as long as somebody is listening to the scientists at NASA, as long as somebody can be the goal of a navigation algorithm. So often I don't care what robot is a leader, as long as I can have just one. I don't want two, don't want zero, want one. And here we go. Okay, so now we want to leave Mars, and we want to do so in a nice, orderly fashion. So I'm going to move this one over here. This one is the leader because it's the lowest ID. There is some robot out here that is the highest ID. I don't know where it is. All the other robots know they are neither the highest nor the lowest. So if you are a robot, you're going to look in your neighborhood and find the highest ID that's less than yours and the lowest ID that's greater than yours, and then physically go in between those two robots. That creates a straight line segment that's three robots long. If they're all doing that, by induction, you end up with a globally straight line, even though no single robot has any notion of a global straight line. So off we go. There's 113 over there. So that worked out. That placement worked out pretty well. And all the other robots are trying to find their place in the line. They're trying to find somebody who's less than them, someone who's greater than them, and physically get in between. And they've tied themselves into a little bit of a knot here. This is a good time to explain about algorithm design. So in these sorts of algorithms, I can guarantee, provably so, that if they settle into a configuration, it will be a good configuration. I cannot tell you how long it will take to get there. And often there's types of algorithms in computer science that are just like this. You can either prove that you're going to get to the goal configuration, but you don't know how long, or prove that you'll stop running after a certain amount of time, but you're not quite sure you're in a good configuration. Everything I do is in this first list. And they've gotten themselves sorted out. That worked pretty well, actually. So they've all done a great job. They got themselves sorted out. They're going to jostle a little bit over there. So they've got themselves lined up in order. And just to make it clear that they have no idea they're making a straight line, if I pull on this robot here and force it to bend, they all happily make a chevron, not a straight line. I put them back in, and they will eventually settle back into their straight line configuration. Okay, so there's our demo. Let's get them all gathered. So in this last algorithm, the blue robots are going to stay put, and the red robots are going to cluster around them, rather around them to all get home. So if you are a Marine, this is a bounding Overwatch retreat. If you are into fairy tales, this is breadcrumbs from Hansel and Gretel, and robots become breadcrumbs at different times. Okay, there we go. So those are the behaviors. And now let's go under the hood a little bit and talk about where these things come from. So here's what my lab used to look like at iRobot years ago before I took it over to build Roombas. And let's go do something useful. So you've seen kind of toy stuff on the stage. Here's a useful application. We're going to see blue robots on the boundary. They're going to ask red robots to push them forward into unexplored space. Green robots, or rather white robots, are going to lead us to the treasure. And green robots have low batteries. They're going to go off and go charge. This video is sped up about 10 times. So you can see the blue robots out on the boundaries, and the red robots are pushing them forward. So they're kind of expanding into the space like a gas, kind of. But the gas is directed by the blue robots. The treasure is hidden over there in those tables. The treasure today was an orange ball. Robots aren't very smart. You can tell them anything is treasure, and they believe you. When the lights go back off, you can see the white robots. Those are guides. So you could follow those to the treasure. Green robot right there, going back home to go charge. We had automatic charging and docking back then. When they're all done exploring, here's that bounded Overwatch retreat again, where they're all leaving breadcrumbs and navigating back home. The keen of eye will note that one little robot didn't really have a good day that day. We had 104 robots deployed. One robot didn't make it home. That's less than 1%. That is just fine. So where does all this stuff come from? And as you may have guessed from the theme of the lecture series, is nature. I spent a lot of time studying ants, bees, termites, and wasps to try to understand how they build their communities, how they do their colonies. These ants down here, in fact, Campanotus pennsylvanicus, were my pet ants for many years. That queen lasted, she lived for 17 years before she finally gave up the ghost. So ants all the way down to the kitchen counter. Leafcutter ants over here, this is a weaver ant, Ecophila, leaving a trail. Termite nest, macrotermites, and leafcutter ants again, pulling leaf together to build a bivouac. Here's work from Thomas Steele. He's a really stellar biologist at Cornell. He studies honeybees. He's trying for decades to try to understand how they make decisions. And in this diagram, he's trying to figure out how honeybees decide who's going to forage from what nectar site and how information is shared in the honeybee hive. And the text is not very clear, but what's important is what this looks like to a computer scientist. This looks like a flowchart. This looks like bee software. I could take this, slap some semicolons on this, and expect to run this through my robots and have this do something interesting. And that would be great, right? We could learn from biology, and biology can learn from us. So there are a lot of similarities between what I do in nature. The first thing is that local sensing, local computation. Ants don't have internet, cell phones, Instagram, FaceTweet. They can't do any of that stuff. They have to make all their decisions based on what they can sense locally. No central computers, no storage. And also, ants and honeybees live kind of in a two-dimensional world. Honeybees don't fly very high. They kind of are close to the ground. But there's some big differences. Nature, complex, highly functional systems, that's great because they work. That's bad because they're hard to study. In robotics, we have simple, mostly broken systems that are very easy to study. Likewise, we can't reprogram the ants. We can poke at them and test them, but we can't change the software to see what would happen. You can do that with robots. Ants have had 120 million years of development to get their software right. We've got 50 years of development. So they've had a lot of time to debug their... You get it? You get it? Debug? All right. Having software, let me go back and set this up, sorry. But having software isn't enough. I'm sorry, you guys, well, you're welcome to stay if you want, actually. Or you can, we're fine. So having brains is not enough if you want to build biologically inspired systems, bodies are important too, because it turns out we can do computation with our bodies. So here is a very fancy robot being kicked by an engineer. And this is now an old, I should put the date on here. This robot is probably 8 years old now, maybe even 10 years old. But at the time, this was totally state of the art. It's carrying 100 kilograms. The engineer just gave it a really good kick, and it's got itself stable, and it's not falling over. That's really impressive, right? Exactly. So how about a cockroach? So here's a cockroach, and this cockroach has a cannon on its back, because sometimes they do that. And the cannon fires, boom, and the recoil sends the cockroach sideways. But within 2 footsteps, the cockroach is already starting to correct and has now got itself straight again. And when the biologists went and studied this, looking at it very carefully with high-speed video and timing, they learned that the roach begins to correct faster than a reflex arc from the leg through the neurons back to the muscle. So somehow it can know what's happening before it can do a simple reflex, like you get kicked in the knee. It can't, so obviously that can't work. But obviously it does work, so now you need to hit that with some science sticks just to understand what's happening there. And what's happening is that the structure of the animal skeleton, the way the legs are designed, the way the joints are arranged, the muscles act like springs, the body acts like a mass, there's dampers in there, that whole mechanical system is set up to self-stabilize. So the cockroach does not need to worry about keeping itself straight, very much like you can take your hands off a bicycle and the front wheel will stay straight. The cockroach kind of has that same kind of stuff built into the way the legs are worked. So they call that preflexes because they happen before reflexes. And having that body means that the cockroach doesn't need to have brain cells dedicated to walking straight. They can just let his body handle it. Good stuff. Okay, so what have we learned? We've learned that brains need bodies. We've learned that simple individuals can produce complex group behaviors. We've also seen, I tried to show that population size matters. With 100 robots, I showed you in the demo, we can explore a Mars, we can explore the room. With 100,000 robots, well, now we can map this whole building just by flooding the floor of the building. Anywhere where a robot isn't is a wall at that point in time. If we have 100 million robots, that would be a fantastic job. Well, 100 million Wallies drop on a landfill, come back a few years later, you have nice sort of piles of stuff. That would be great. Even more than that, and we don't fully understand populations and no sizes. So this is what we learned from nature. This is good stuff. Okay, so I think that's going to stop there, yes. And now we're going to move on to, so that's the nature side, now the computer science side, distributed algorithms. So this is the meat of what I work on. And here's the swarm at Rice University. This is the swarm of robots. In order to build a swarm of robots, you need a swarm of students. And these 2 grad students, you'll be seeing the work from their PhD thesis. And lots of people with the lab to help get these robots built. So, full credit. Of course, we can't sit and let you read all the names. But love them all. Off we go. So when we do the math in these robots, we can't think about it as a whole big complicated robot. We have to simplify it to just a circle that's facing in a particular direction. You get a lot of them. There's your swarm. Each robot has a small communication range, lets it talk to its neighbors and find its neighbors in geometry. Then you get all those little local networks and you end up with a large group network. So this is how they build a communication, how they talk to each other. When you've got this global network with geometry, you can start to figure some things out. You saw in the building example, robots on the perimeter were blue, and they were leading the robots out into unexplored areas. But in this example, there are 2 perimeters. There's internal voids as well. So maybe this is a rock or a big pit in the ground that just keep on falling into. Hard to tell, but with the green robots there, you know to stop before you fall. We'll skip this one. Oh, no, I won't. So the robots are exploring. You saw them in the video, they spread out like a gas. In this video, they're spreading out in a nice triangular pattern. So they're trying to make these triangles. Once they have the triangles, then these 2 robots can explore using the triangles as guides. So this is like the same way video game graphics look, all these little triangles to make up pictures. The robots are using those to figure out where to go next. So now you can explore the museum, for example, or you can do security patrol without knowing the floor plan of the building just by looking at the triangles. When the robots were recovering after the exploration, some robots had their blue lights on. They stayed put. Other robots were green robots, and they were navigating using the blue robots as landmarks. Here's what that looks like in simulation to get all the blue robots back home, to get all the robots back home. So the blue robots stay put until they don't need to anymore. Okay, the last thing we showed you was my favorite, was a sorting algorithm. And I said that one robot is the lowest, number 2, one robot is the highest, number 9. These two robots stay put, number 5, to sort this list. This is pretty easy. You just drive here, and now we're done. That's not very exciting at all. When you've got more robots, now it gets a little more interesting. So robot 7 wants to go between 5 and 9. 3 wants to go between 2 and 5. And 5 wants to go between 7 and 3. So if they all just do that, they end up like this. Huh, it still looks like a mess. If you do the exact same procedure again, you get this. You do the exact same procedure again, you get this. That's starting to look a lot like a sorted line now. Let's back up a little bit and do a little bit of computer science theory. Okay, so if you look, imagine a rubber band put around these robots. If you are a computer scientist, that's called a convex hull. If you're not, a rubber band is just fine. So if you put a rubber band around that shape and then do this, you'll notice that if you put a rubber band around this shape, that shape has less area. It's getting smaller. The rubber band is getting smaller. You do it again, you've got even less area. One more time, even less. So now you can break out your math and prove that the area that these robots will cover eventually goes to zero. And if you cover no area, you have a line. We spent a whole lot of time trying to figure out how long that will take and to prove it will get there. And we got about 95% of the way there. And that was one of the papers that was a bear to get published because we had to publish an incomplete result. There are some reviews, some editors that were not as pleasant as they wanted them to be. But we got it out eventually, which was good, because he did a brilliant job getting this reduced to an algorithm. But it looks easy, and turns out it's not. Okay, so the last thing, going back to biology, we looked at was manipulation. So here are these ants with a potato chip, and they're doing a good job carrying it around. Ants do this very well. So how do you get robots to do this? Well, the first thing you do is you cheat, and you make a potato chip that's big, a nice big potato chip, and you give it little handles. You build robots with these grippers, and the grippers can... and so they can close and grip on the thing. Okay, great. So now, and in full disclosure, these robots are being driven by undergraduates off camera, but we did get these algorithms to work autonomously about 9 months later, which is good because Golnaz Habibi needed to graduate and be a doctor, be Dr. Golnaz. So you can move left, you can move right, you can rotate. Everything you'd want to do with your potato chip, you can now do with robots. Yay! Okay, so that was straight from my lab. Now let's move on to do a fun thing with us. So this is a group activity, and I'm going to want 8 volunteers. You guys are a little too young, unfortunately. So middle school, you might be old enough. Middle school? Okay, come on. So middle school and older, please. I'd like 8 volunteers, and I'd like there to be a gender-balanced group. Gender balance. Gender balance is important in science and technology, and that's what we like to get. Gender balance means as many guys as gals. Come on up. Surely we have more people who want to come up and do this. No, we need you guys to be a little older. Come on, people. 4 more? Okay. They're coming. Here they come. I think we've got it. Okay, we got our balance, we have our numbers. Come back. Come back. I miscounted. Okay, please, everyone gets a calculator. Okay, everyone gets a card. Okay, so everyone on the stage so people can see you, because it's no fun to be off the stage. And the number one rule of being on stage, don't kick the robots. So let's move forward a little bit. Okay, so what I want you people to do is average, hold your cards up so everyone can see that you do have different numbers. I know there are 2 number 40s cut me some slack. But what I want you to do is average all these eight numbers. But wait, I don't want you to add them up and divide by eight. That's really boring. I wouldn't ask you on stage to do that. I want you to do it using a distributed algorithm. So let me explain. An algorithm is a procedure for doing something. Like, for example, if you're baking a cake, a recipe is an algorithm. You start with some ingredients, preconditions. You run your algorithm, your procedure. At the end, you get an output, a cake, maybe even chocolate, which would be good. So that's an algorithm. A distributed algorithm is run on many, many chefs. So distributed algorithm, and we're going to average numbers. Okay. Whoops. So the way it works is I want you to each enter the starting number into your calculator. So, yep, the number on your card goes into your calculator. Everyone got that? You got some nods? All righty. So now you don't need your cards. I'll collect the cards. And now I want you to find a partner. Everybody partner up. Okay. Now I want you to, with your partner, compute the local average between your two numbers. So take her number, add it to yours. So 80 plus, what did you have? 120? So 80 plus 120.
And then divide.
And then divide by 2.
Yeah.
Okay, and that equals 100. And you should also have 100, right? So the two of you, when you're done, should have the same number. Yes? Go find a new partner, take your new number, and add it to there, and then do an average with your new partner's number, and keep on repeating. Okay, go find a new partner, take your new number. Yep, new partner, new number. Okay, I think we have time for a few questions while our computer's running. I don't know if there's a mic running around. So I'll repeat the question. Do you have a question? So the question was, how do I get that many to follow the leader? So the answer is that I add them one at a time. So in the follow algorithm, the first one is the leader because it has the lowest number. So that one's already in the follow. That one literally looks around. And remember that they can communicate, but they can also know where their neighbors are. So if I look at this group here, I'm going to pick the closest robot, this lady in the green. Hi. So I'm going to say, hey, I pick you. You are now 2 of 7. You look around, find the person closest to you, which should be this lady right here, and say, you're 3 of 7. And then she picks the next person, which would be you, and so forth and so on. So it goes on the line until we get to 7 of 7 right here, and then you don't recruit anyone else because you are 7 of 7. You stop. So that's how follow works. And then as I drive the leader, the one who is number 2 tries to move toward me, but then wants to maintain a 50-centimeter distance. So if it goes more than 50 centimeters, it slows down. If it's further than 50 centimeters, it speeds up. So that kind of feedback on the distance keeps it close enough to have a nice organized chain of robots. And then the last thing actually is that if all the robots are in the same spot, you can't see the train. Then I have to drive it carefully so that the train is obvious to everyone in the room. Let's do one more quickly. I think where our computer has either we're broken or we're converging. I can't tell. Let me ask your question and see what happened.
So the light show done at the Olympics recently with drones, was it using this kind of technology?
I actually missed it. Although I would say almost certainly not. Almost certainly because that had to be tight and synchronized and camera ready. Almost certainly, there may have been parts of it that were local, but I would bet 90% of it was hardcore GPS, big giant servers, notion of where the thing was and boundaries, and there may be some visual landmarks for the drones to see, but it was almost all done probably remotely. So because, on stage, I can be content if things don't work properly. If you're doing a drone show for the Olympics, that needs to be perfect. There's no one's going to forgive you if they don't line up for that one. Okay, so let's see what's going on here. Okay, what you got? So you guys have got some big numbers. When your numbers get big, it's sometimes just good. You can just round them off a little bit.
So over 0.5, go to the next one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, let's have you guys work a little bit longer. And keep on mixing. So also, one person can do the computation, and the second person can copy the number. Yeah. So I've done this a lot. I've done this lots and lots of times. Almost always, middle school students nail it every time. College students, you get kind of this kind of thing here. Professional engineers, I have to restart them. They always mess it up terribly. Go ahead, what's your question?
How do robots on Mars get like rocks or fossils back to Earth?
The question was, how do robots on Mars get rocks and fossils back to Earth? That's a fantastic question. The answer is that they don't. There is no way at all to get a fossil from Mars and to get it back off of Mars and back to Earth. We would love to have that. That would be super, super exciting. But I was about to go through a lecture on the energetics of orbital mechanics. Let me back this up. I have a Lego model of a rocket, and it is this tall, and it's the Saturn V rocket. This is the one that took astronauts to the moon. It's this tall. It's a really cute model because at the time I built it, my son was only this tall, so I had to hold him up. It was great. So, and the people to scale are this tall. So three of them are in a rocket this tall, and the people are up here at the top. So the people are right here, right? So my thumb is where the people are. Everything from here to the ground is gas to get these three people to the moon. It takes that much gas to get, gravity is kind of heavy, to get out of Earth's atmosphere and then aim at the moon. And once they aim at the moon, they coast the rest of the way. But in order to get from Earth to aimed at the moon, you have to burn this much fuel for three people. So if you want to then add all the fuel that it would take to then get from Mars back and then lift that off of Earth, the rocket would be too big to fly. So it comes down to fuel. So the only way we're going to get rockets from Mars to Earth is if we somehow build fuel on Mars and build the rocket on Mars, which would be awesome. That would be something that you could do in your engineering career. Okay, so let's go to our computer and see how we're doing. I think we'll stop and see what we got. Okay, let's get you guys to line up. And get this off. What do you have?
93.6.
94.2.
93.6.
96.6.
94.2.
96.6.
96.6.
Fantastic.
175.
Okay, we're gonna ignore that last one. And we're gonna notice that all the numbers are awfully close together. So they did converge to a very similar answer. And it's even close to the right answer. You're close. But you did converge. Thank you all very much for coming up. Please. You can put the calculators, just drop them off. Okay. So that almost very nearly worked. We got half of the things we wanted. We wanted all the numbers to be the same, and we wanted them all to be the actual average. So here's what they were doing. It's all explained very clearly right here. Actually, this is only half of it. The real stuff is in this paper, which goes into it in gory detail. It's easier to see with a quick simulation, though. Here are the numbers I gave them, and there are two ways to think about what's going to happen. So if you're number 10, and you average with any other number, you're never going to be as small as 10 again. You're going to get bigger. Likewise, if you're 120, you're going to get smaller. So the maximum and minimum are going to contract at each step. The max and the min are always going to move toward each other. If you know some more statistics, you can say that there's a certain amount of variance that these said numbers starts with. So variance tells you how much numbers, well, vary. These numbers, when they start, are quite varied. There's a lot of variance. Every time you compute a local average, I have 10, you have 30, we compute a local average, now we both have 20, there is no more variance between our two numbers. We've lost some variance. Once all the variance goes away, then we all must have the same number. So at the end, there's no variance anymore, or very little variance. It actually doesn't all go away, it exponentially approaches zero, blah, blah, blah. But we're engineers now, that's zero. And then the proof to show that it converges to the average is actually it was problem set it was question two on problem set one of my grad distributed robotics course. So it's not terribly hard, but it's harder than I'm going to do here. But it works. So why would you do this? Aside from having an electro demo and a fun thing to do for a parlor trick, why would you compute an average in this crazy way? Well, maybe you don't know how many robots you have, so you can't just add them all up and divide by n, because you don't know what n is. And if you're on Mars, maybe there's a pit, maybe a Martian steps on them, so n could change. So doing this lets you deal with the fact that n changes. Or maybe you don't know what a number is at all. Maybe you're a honeybee. So ants, bee, and bees share food with each other all the time. This is the queen laying an egg. I thought that was a really cool picture. But I should have had a picture of what's called trophallaxis, where worker ants get together and share food with each other. So if ants are sharing food all the time, they're computing local averages of food. Therefore, if I'm, have I been saying ant? These are obviously bees. Ants and bees are cousins. They're both hymenopteros. They're related. They're all actually related to wasps, which was first. Then ants lost their wings, and bees got highly organized and built things, and they had honey, whatever. So if you share food all the time, you're computing local averages. If they're all computing a local average, that means if I'm hungry, I'm a honeybee, I'm hungry, I can assume that everyone else has the same amount of food that I do, so I can now make a local decision to go get food based on global information. So I can locally make a choice. I'm gonna go get some food because I'm hungry, and therefore everyone else must be hungry. And that's actually how it works. It's a little more complicated, but that's pretty much how it works. It's neat stuff. There we go. So actually biologically inspired. Okay. I think this says what I just said. Yes. I've been measuring when she is hungry. Okay. So there we go. That concludes the part of the lecture about robots and nature. Now we're going to quickly tell you a little bit about where I came from. And here's one of my favorite pictures. This is me and two robots and two Hollywood actors. The robots are down in the lower right. And this is not, that's not some birthday party C-3PO. That's Anthony Daniels. Human cyborg relations. I mean, it's fantastic. So he walks around, he's like this normal, proper English gentleman, and then when he gets into character, it's like, whoa, that guy's C-3PO. Holy smokes. So great picture. Where does the picture come from? You have to go back in time. Whoa, too far back. Okay. Like every good engineer, I was hatched from a cardboard box. Turns out cardboard boxes are really great construction materials. You can build all kinds of good stuff with cardboard boxes. Model trains, had my train set when I was four. I don't remember it, but my dad had a great time. As I got older, I learned really good hands-on crafting from playing at model trains. Lego, the pinnacle of all mechanical engineering prototyping kits. You gotta have a lot of Lego in the house if you wanna have an engineer. Video games, back when I was little, they weren't the giant Grand Theft Auto things they are today. They were smaller Angry Birds kind of things. Things that you could sit down and either copy from a magazine or write yourself, which is a lot of fun, by the way. Making video games is a lot of fun. I encourage you all to do it. But learn good computer science. BMX bicycles, there I am trying to get to the top of my friend's garage. I did not make it to the top of the garage that day. I spent most of my high school career trying to get a reliable, robust two-speed system to work on my BMX bicycle. And when my weld would fail, I'd end up in the ER. Turns out you learn a lot of good engineering in the emergency room. The solution, by the way, to a two-speed system on a BMX bike that can handle the rigors of BMXing is a 1954 Sturmey Archer three-speed hub, indestructible, bulletproof. It was a tank. It made the bike, but I was fast. It worked. And then finally, radio-controlled cars. Again, these are not your kind of dinky toy store kind of things. These are 40-mile-an-hour, break your ankle, back to the ER, kind of serious electromechanical systems. So you put all that together in the head of a high school student, and you end up with this. This is Rover, my first robot. And the key feature of Rover is this water gun right here. So if my mother would stand perfectly, perfectly still, I could sneak up on her and squirt her in the ankle. This is before I understood sensors and vision and feedback, so if she moved at all, then I would just be squirting in the kitchen. So I had to go learn more and more about robotics. I went to school to do just that. There I am, freshman year, and you can see the BMX theme art on the wall still. I went on to study ants. Here's my ant condo. and went to go build some ant robots, which was a lot of fun. They got me that degree right there. That one right there is mine. And I love this picture, right? I didn't even have enough time to get my camera level, and these two jokers stop and struck a pose. That's Chuck Vest and Provost, whose name leaves me right now. But both of them are just perfect, like great. Went on to iRobot, built the Swarm, the robots you see down here on the stage right now. And then people noticed the Swarm, cool stuff, right? So you've got cool robots, you seem to be having a good time with them. So the Lemelson asked me, why don't you be in our exhibit on invention and play? So they put me in the exhibit. They didn't tell me they were putting posters in the metro. So I got off the train, and I didn't know what to do, so I took a picture of myself next to the picture of myself. Very surreal. Third grade students, like your robots, they make science reports. The author is visible at the bottom of the image there. Fourth grade students, I went to go visit my mother's school, and they were so inspired by the demo that they made me a quilt, which is awesome. It was also useful when I was doing my finishing my thesis. Time magazine asked me to be in their article on the rise of robots, so here I am with the swarm keeper, they called me, in my beekeeping outfit. Or rather, they brought one because I learned my wife and I were going to have bees, but she's allergic, turns out. So no bees for us. I know, it's very sad. So when the Science of Star Wars asked me to do, I want to come out to LA and film with Anthony Daniels and R2-D2, I thought about that for about 30 milliseconds and said, yeah, I'm on the plane. I spent the next 2 weeks writing software to have the robots spread out in a Starburst pattern from Anthony Daniels' feet, and I got them to play the Star Wars theme as a little orchestral choir. Which you have that DVD, the theme is actually at the back of the DVD. They used my song for the closing credits, which was very nice, quite nice. So that got me on their TV show, which got my robots at the feet of those two Hollywood robots and got me this great picture, which sits on my mantle, and he signed my robot, which is really quite nice. And it leaves me with this quote, a master of our living draws no sharp distinctions between work and play. So I want to encourage you all to play hard.
There, great. Thank you, James. And I can't wait until you get into 3D and we see them flying. That'll be great. Before we open the floor to questions, I've got three quick announcements. First, I want to invite you again on March 29th to come join us at the Salt Lake City Main Library for our next speaker in the series, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering here at the University of Utah, Stephen Nalloway, and he's going to continue the conversation we've had tonight on biomimicry. Second, tickets for this year's keynote lecture are on sale now. Neri Oxman is the founder and director of the design research group Mediated Matter and an associate professor of media arts and science at MIT. And her keynote address will conclude this year's series on April 9th at Kingsbury Hall. And you can find info on tickets at nhmu.utah.edu. And then finally, we're actually going to repeat tonight's lecture at the Viridian Center in West Jordan. And so if you know somebody who might be interested, please encourage them to join us. And you can also listen to it. Again, it'll be broadcast on KCPW 88.3 FM Friday morning at 10 and again at 8. And the lecture will also be available as a podcast that you can find on KCPW's webpage, kcpw.org. So now let's take a few questions. We have a microphone over here and one over here and one in the back. So raise your hand and we'll find you.
In our Mars simulation, when the swarm found the shiny shoe, you mentioned that one of the robots might have been specialized with like a spectrometer who'd like to see that shoe. How would the swarm know? Would they know that specific robot had that, or would they ask all the robots if they had more interest in the shoe?
Yeah, and ask is an overstatement. The way the code works now, whoever finds a shoe just says, "I found a shoe," or "I found a thing that's not a rock and dirt." It's a thing. I don't know what it is. The notion of heterogeneity in these systems, though, is one that still there's a lot of open academic work on that, because in this case, you know, the robots may be all essentially 99% the same, maybe with different sensor packets. But if you start changing their abilities or their mobility or their size, their batteries, or maybe you have a robot that's a carrier for other robots, or you know, you can expand the notion of differences in physiology or engineering to infinity, basically. And that mathematically now gets very hard, because you can't assume that any robot is replaceable by any other robot. So the proofs and the algorithms, when you have those kind of heterogeneous system, you have two, now you have to consider case A and case B, and then the other two cases where it's not just A or B, where it's A plus B and then B plus A, you have three robots, now you have eight cases, you have four robots, you have 16, you have eight robots, 256, 16 robots, 65,536, and the numbers get big quick. So it gets hard. It can get hard. You can simplify it, but it's not something that I looked at, and the research on that is still somewhat nascent. We're not there yet.
When you were getting the robots to organize themselves numerically, why did you use bubble sort instead of merge?
A plant. So she's asking you about two different sorting algorithms. A bubble sort is what I used, where you have a low number and it checks, bubbles its way up to get to where it's gonna go. Merge sort, you take big, move them around. Merge sort is more efficient. It runs an n log n running time. If you have it, your data structure designed properly. The reason is that the physical movement is very hard to do. It's easy to move individual robots. But the real reason is the bubble sort, that in the physical bubble sort, it all runs in parallel. So the notion of running time changes with physical algorithms. You're not worried about a single computer operating on a single data structure. The data structure itself operates on itself and can all run in parallel. So running time is now defined not how long it takes to actually sort the numbers, but how long it takes to physically get from point A to point B. So the running time of that algorithm is the longest distance any one robot needs to travel. You could try to optimize the communications. You could say, well, I don't want them to have to share a lot of information. I want to minimize the communications because it's easier, it uses less bandwidth. But turns out just moving around requires communication. If I'm talking to you and I move over here and you go dark, I don't know where you are. If you're moving and you're not talking, I have no idea where you are. So their basic network configuration requires periodic communication, so you always have a lower bound on communication. As long as you don't increase that too much, algorithmically it works out to be this a wash. So the notions of computational complexity change with these things. I recognize I went deep, sorry. But it changed, and you have to think about physical computation. So distances and what kind of motion you can get as a group or as opposed to individuals. And you have to go back and rethink kind of how you're going to talk about running time and algorithms. Okay. I'll keep it. But I love the question, though. Thank you.
So watching you watch your robots, you're intimately aware of the software code that they're running. So you can see that you could observe their behavior and intuit what the software was doing.
Yes.
What is a natural system that you've observed where you've been impressed at what it's doing and tried to figure out
all
the software running?
So all of them is yes. So I thought actually you were going to say, I thought you'd go a different direction. The direction I thought you were going to go in was, I know the code, I built them, but do I still see personality? So that's what I thought you were going to say. And the answer, I have to admit, kind of, yeah, a little bit. And we didn't set out to make them particularly attractive. We tried. We didn't want to make them ugly. But the way they move and the errors they make, and they look lost, and they're kind of helpless, they're not very big, they really do evoke cuteness, which was not really where we're trying to go. The question you asked, though, which was, it was...
A natural system.
Yes. Basically, any natural system that I look at in any detail, it blows me away. And you know, I talked about ants, bees, termites, and wasps. I also brushed up against sponges, which turns out are little systems of single-celled organisms that make up sponges, and they swim around within the sponge to move nutrients around and do repairs and do other things like that. You can look at systems. The stock market is a distributed system where everyone's trying to make local trading decisions to maximize their profit, and as a result, you get group movements up and down. Now that it's all algorithmic, fantastically rapid group movements because we don't really understand the algorithms that are running. And no one sat down. You know, I've got proofs that show what my stuff does. No one sat down and done proofs on Wall Street. You can't do that. But so natural systems. Let's see. What do I like? I sat next to a 777 pilot on the way out here, and he was talking about when he gets his plane close to the ground, he can feel the bounce. All planes do this. Are there pilots in the room? Anyone who flies? So you get close to the ground, and you get a little bounce from the ground effect. So what is ground effect? Ground effect happens as you get, if you're flying, you're generating pressure differentials between the top of your wings and the bottom of your wings. You get close to a hard surface, and there's a bit of reflected pressure that lifts you up. You increase the pressure under the bottom of your wing a little bit. It's about one wing length off the ground. So if you were out in nature and you're looking at water birds, as they fly water, they'll sit on the water, and then they will take off, sit very close to the water as they build up speed. They're sitting in the ground effect to give them an extra boost of lift as they build up speed. Once they have the speed they like, then they pop off and increase their altitude to go up. So what else do I see with nature? I look at squirrels and how they are climbing and scampering through the trees. So they've got gyros. We all have gyros. We have two in our ears. We have inner ears, so we're all gyro-stabilized. I used to have a great video in my class with a cheetah that was hunting a gazelle, and it was a slow-mo, which is a shame because David Attenborough has this beautiful, proper accent when he's talking. But slow-mo and the cheetah, you know, they're moving at 40 miles an hour. They're doing a sharp right turn. The cheetah's head is dead steady. You want to talk about a steady cam? Dead steady, binocular eyes, dead on the target. The cheetah was at a 45 degree turn angle. When I'm at that angle on my motorcycle, I could not be target fixated on an animal that's jinking and weaving in front of me. And it didn't end well for the gazelle, as you may guess. But that kind of inertial state, it's just fed. So I can go on. I'm a naturalist. I love looking at nature and the engineering. Those creatures in the wall, in the room behind us, those big, giant, massive things with energetics and dynamics and population patterns that we're just now trying to unravel, and how their birth and life and death cycles that we don't fully understand. I mean, just, okay. So a lot is the answer. I love nature, and when you get into almost any system, you can find something somewhere. All the way in the back, way in the back in the blue.
Just a question. Can you kind of describe some of the challenges you ran into with traditional leader election algorithms like Paxos or Raft? Because I assume that with the robotics of the network, it's a lot harder to guarantee some of the things you'd need for that.
Another plant, this one with a more advanced degree, let's talk about Paxos. So let me dig up my Paxos algorithm. So Paxos, I think the core way Paxos fails, yes, we don't have reliable communications. Paxos assumes you can get a message. No, it doesn't. Oh, dear. It's been a long time. So if I were giving me a qualifying exam, I would not be doing well right now. I'm trying to remember if Paxos assumes reliable communications or not. This is an offline question, and I'm gonna need the help of the internet to get me refreshed. So Paxos is a classic algorithm, a famous algorithm. Is that Lamport? Paxos? I think so. It allows distributed systems to reach consensus. Why do you care about this? You care about this because when you go to the ATM and you put $50 into the ATM, you want to pull up your phone and your computer and go into the bank and have that $50 show up. The ATM, your phone, the bank all have to be in consensus. The problem with that, if you want to reach consensus, you have to guarantee that I know what you know that you know that I know that you know that I know, that the $50 is there. The problem with that is that if you can lose a message anywhere in this process, and it's obvious, if you put $50 in and someone cuts the wire on the ATM and it never tells anybody that you put $50 in, nobody else will know, you just put $50 into a piece of metal that you're never gonna see again. This is bad. If you put $50 in and then it gets to the bank increases it, but doesn't tell the ATM that it's got it. The ATM now thinks that your account still is $50 low, so when you go look at your balance in the ATM, it shows an incorrect amount and you're mad again. So anytime you can lose a message, you can provably guarantee that you cannot reach consensus. The way the ATM solve this is that they have a history of all their transactions. So this now we're getting into distributed database synchronization where I've got my history, you've got your history. If we do lose a message, when we go back and compare histories, we can find the missed transactions, and then the $50 comes over, and then the bank then can then recompute everything from that point going forward so that we're back in sync again. That's how I solve the problem. So that was a long explanation to avoid the fact that I don't remember how Paxos works. So we'll come back to that after offline. Another microphone?
We have one last question.
Excellent, thank you.
I just was wondering if the robots can't, see the things, then how do they know if they found, a fossil or a treasure or something?
So in reality, these robots do have cameras. So they have there's a camera right there in the front. But we never had the time to sit down and write a lot of complicated software to get them to understand what they were seeing. So the software that we did write just looked for a blob of a certain color, and then we picked orange because that was the ball we happened to have that day. So that's how they did the looking for treasure. These robots are for research, so they don't need to be able to do what all the fancy things that real robots can do. A real robot would have to have a sophisticated sensor suite to detect fossils. Maybe that's complicated, where they have a camera, they have vision, they have an image in their head of what a fossil looks like, and they're comparing that every time they take a picture. Or maybe it's simple. Maybe they look for anything that has regular striations that don't match the striations of the surrounding rock. So they look for a texture change. So here is uniform texture. Here is texture that's different. This is not one of these things is not like the other. And that may be enough to then call over a bigger robot with a camera, and either that bigger robot has big fat software that then figures out what it is, or takes a picture and sends it to big fat smart engineers in NASA to figure it out. But great question. All right. That's a fine place to stop. Thank you all very much for coming out.